This is VOA News, via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. Former U.S. Vice President Joe Biden is the projected winner of the U.S. presidency and stands to be inaugurated on January 20th, becoming the country's oldest leader ever. Mr. Biden has been a fixture in Washington politics for nearly half a century. The Democrat served 36 years in the U.S. Senate and 8 years as second-in-command to former President Barack Obama. The results still must be officially certified and are subject to court challenges, but they are expected to stand. Biden won the presidency by capturing at least 270 of the 538 Electoral College votes. Biden's victory came days after the official election day on Tuesday, as election officials in half a dozen states completed tabulating millions of votes on mail-in ballots sent in by voters who wanted to stay away from polling stations out of fear of the coronavirus. Biden, who will be 78 by Inauguration Day, won the presidency on his third try after failing to win the Democratic Party nomination in both 1988 and 2008. Now he will take over the U.S. government, accompanied by his vice presidential running mate, California Senator Kamala Harris, the first woman in the country's 244-year history ever elected as either president or vice president. She is the daughter of a Jamaican father and an Indian mother and was the first woman of color on a U.S. national political ticket. Biden has promised the U.S. will re-engage across the world, rejoining the Paris Climate Change Accord and the pact to restrain Iran from nuclear weapons development. Trump's America First credo resulted in the U.S. withdrawal from several international treaties. For more on this story as it develops throughout the day, please visit our website at voanews.com or download our easy-to-use app to your mobile device. This is VOA News. In other election news around the world, Guinea's Constitutional Court on Saturday declared incumbent Alpha Condé had been reelected for a controversial third term as president and at the age of 82. At 59.5%, Condé's support was above the absolute majority needed to win in the first round, judges found, throwing out challenges to the October 18th ballot from opposition figures. His main opponent received 33.5% of the vote, according to the official count. Guinea's vote was held after a new constitution bypassed a two-year presidential limit and was followed by violence the opposition says has claimed 46 lives. There's no way for Condé's opponents to appeal the Constitutional Court decision, leaving the path formally clear for the president to begin a new six-year term. Egyptians began voting Saturday in the second phase of a parliamentary election in which supporters of President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi are expected to win. Some 63 million of Egypt's more than 100 million people are eligible to elect 568 of the 596 lawmakers in the lower house, which many see as a rubber stamp body for executive policies. The remaining deputies will be appointed by Sisi, a former general whose government over the past 6 years has cracked down on dissent, targeting journalists, bloggers, lawyers, and intellectuals. The first phase of voting took place last weekend in 14 regions, including the Mediterranean city of Alexandria and the south of Egypt. The second and final phase, which wraps up on Sunday evening, is being held in 13 regions, including Cairo, the Nile Delta, and the Suez Canal. The new parliament will be the second to convene under Sisi, who took office in 2014 after leading the military's ouster of Islamist President Mohamed Morsi the previous year. Denmark and the United States are among six countries that have reported new coronavirus cases linked to mink farms, the World Health Organization is saying. Italy, the Netherlands, Spain, and Sweden are the other nations to have discovered it, WHO said in a statement. Denmark has imposed strict measures on the north of the country after warning that a mutation of the virus had jumped from minks to humans and infected 12 people. Copenhagen has warned the mutation could threaten the effectiveness of any future vaccine and has ordered the slaughter of all the estimated 15 to 17 million minks in the country. Again, we invite you to visit our website for more on these and other international stories. That's voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
One of the things we'd like to be able to do is sit down and look at the strategic document that was in place and see if there are things we can carry on, and if there are things that we think we need to revise, we'll be able to do that so that we give our people the credibility and the sanctity of an institution that is at the very foundation of a democratic culture.
The chairperson of the Malawi Electoral Commission monitors the U.S. elections.
There's not such an election being won, and all cases before the Supreme Court in Uganda have reported extreme violence and rigging. They only lacked courage, like other courts have done in the region, to reject the outcome of the election.
Ugandan opposition party, the National Unity Platform, launches its manifesto Saturday.
As a political party, the People's Democratic Party has already stated, and very clearly so, that it will not support any attempt to strangulate the social media under the guise of being after fake news reporters.
And a major Nigerian opposition party says it will resist attempts to regulate social media. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The chairperson of the Malawi Electoral Commission has been praised for organizing a presidential rerun seen as transparent and credible. The poll repeat saw incumbent President Professor Arthur Peter Mutharika defeated by main opposition leader Dr. Lazarus Chakwera. Dr. Chakwera has since been sworn in as the Southern African country's legitimately elected democratic leader. Dr. Justice Chifundo Kachali is the chairperson of the Malawi Electoral Commission. He is currently in the U.S. where he monitored last week's elections. I reached out to him in the Washington, D.C. area and began by asking his experience in monitoring the U.S. elections, lessons learned, and how he plans to improve the electoral process back home.
Well, I mean, there are various issues that we're observing. I mean, insofar as the logistical and environmental preparation of the space for the people to come and cast their votes were concerned, there was a very high level of preparedness, and even the polling staff took time to explain to us the processes and procedures involved in the whole event. But what was most notable, I think, in most of the polling stations we were able to go out to was that the voter turnout was low because apparently most people had chosen to vote by mail. And so most places we went to, you did not find many people on the line to vote. But insofar as their stats were concerned, they had sent out mail-in ballots to everybody and they'd received quite a good number back.
Did they explain what recourse they have to challenge the outcome of a disputed election?
Insofar as that process is concerned, because we were attending the polling processes, when they've done their polling, they now take the results and take them where the results are processed at the tally center, and we had no access to that particular space. But insofar as the legal provisions are concerned, anybody dissatisfied with the outcome do have recourse to the courts ultimately to determine the outcome of the polls.
Well, you just organized elections in Malawi hailed by local poll observers and by civil society groups. Compare that to what you saw here and what can be improved or what can be taken away to improve the system back home.
Several things would stand out. I think there's a lot of technology uptake that actually facilitates the result processing activities, where all the ballots, whether they're electronic or they're manual, they are already scanned, and all that you have to do at the end of the day to process results is to aggregate the information that's been captured on hard disk, taken to the tally center. And I think that's a very beautiful innovation and a wonderful way to harness the technology to speed up the processes of managing results. The other thing that really stood out in our observation is the level of civic participation by various citizens who actually volunteer to become polling staff. And because you're dealing with people with high levels of exposure who also understand the system very well, they are civically very engaged, I think that creates citizen buy-in into the voting process, and actually it can mitigate some of the suspicions and doubts that people may have about voting processes. So there's a very high level. I mean, we witnessed a few instances of parents coming in with their kids when they're coming to cast their votes, and there was, I think, even a school outing organized by the police who brought some kids to come and observe a polling activity, creating a culture that helps people recognize the importance of casting a vote on a regular basis to ensure that the governed confer legitimacy to those who are governing them. I think for me, that's what stood out, that people are civically engaged and they see the value of playing a role in the voting process.
Are we going to see something of a nature under your administration with the Malawi Electoral Commission?
I think that's not even an option for us. I think the past experience from May 2019 has really generated a high level of civic engagement. I don't think we're ever going back to a space where Malawians will be detached from what happens at the polls. And the interest is already in place, and it will just be a matter of creating a space or a systemic arrangement where you can actually require or challenge the various professionals and different citizens at different levels to actually harness that interest into something more systematic that can actually help consolidate the democratic gains we have attained in the few months that have gone by.
Justice Kachale, what should be the expectations of Malawi under your administration with regards to free, fair, transparent election in terms of implementing measures to strengthen the gains you've already achieved and to build upon that based on the experience you've had with regards to U.S. elections?
Our commission is very fortunate that we're coming in at a time when there was a very extensive functional review process that has already been given approval by the government. We are actually at the verge of beginning to implement that process that will actually create systems in place instead of things depending on who is in office. Things shouldn't depend on personality, but rather you should have systems, procedures, methodologies that are actually inculcated into the mechanism of delivering free, fair, and credible elections. So we're excited about the prospect of being able to put in place systems that are actually transparent, accountable, that are actually responsive to the expectations of the Malawian people. And so that's the agenda that's already in place as a commission. After we organize, because we're now doing some by-elections, I think one of the things we'd like to be able to do is sit down and look at the strategic document that was in place and see if there are things we can carry on, and if there are things that we think we need to revise, we'll be able to do that so that we give people the credibility and the sanctity of an institution that is at the very foundation of a democratic culture.
Dr. Justice Chifundo Kachale is the chairperson of the Malawi Electoral Commission. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. Uganda's Opposition National Unity Platform, or NUP, plans to launch its manifesto Saturday. Popular parliamentarian and presidential candidate Robert Kyagulanyi, also known as Bobi Wine, will head the launch scheduled to be held in Imbarara in the western part of the country. Meanwhile, the police have warned the party to ensure it adheres to the Ministry of Health guidelines. Officials say the guidelines outlined by the Health Ministry forms part of the effort to limit the spread of the novel coronavirus. But some opposition supporters say the guidelines appear to be used by the government to restrict movement and meetings by opposition groups in the run-up to next year's election. Parliamentarian Mathias Mpuuga is a deputy president of the Ugandan Opposition National Unity Platform, NUP. He tells me that the launch of the party's manifesto will give Ugandans the opportunity to see plans to transform their lives under the leadership of Bobi Wine.
It was our intention to launch our manifesto on the nomination day, but like you must have observed, we're not able to reach the venue for the manifesto launch, owing to the abduction and torture of our candidate immediately after nomination on Tuesday. So as a party, we decided that we would choose another place and day, and resolved on Saturday to do the launch in the western part of the country, specifically in Mbarara City, we have no reason to doubt the fact that we shall successfully launch our manifesto in the western part of the country. To make up for the time we lost on Tuesday, but it was important that we get time to speak to the country about our program.
Well, I understand the police have warned your party, the NUP, to adhere to the Ministry of Health guidelines in your manifesto launch. How do you intend adhering to the measures implemented as explained by the Ministry of Health?
I want the world to understand that we are not outlaws as a party. We are not oblivious of the afflictions that COVID has visited our country and our communities. And we can differentiate between SPOs and their enforcement by the police and the politicking by the police. We are Ugandans and we want to lead a healthy people. We also do not want to risk our own lives in trying to do what we want to do in this season. I can only promise that we shall do what we believe is reasonable. We shall do what we believe is acceptable. And therefore, we do not want to really waste a lot of our energies responding to the politicking by the police.
Political campaigns and rallies are banned in Uganda due to the COVID-19 restrictions imposed to limit the spread of the disease. But are you not worried that this manifesto launch could be considered as a rally or a campaign that could attract the attention of law enforcement to possibly scuttle the event, because those are some of the concerns your supporters have raised? How do you deal with this?
What I can state is that our flagship slogan is in Uganda. There's no doubt. But no one is still waiting for Museveni's Uganda. The new Uganda is about new dreams. This is the country that needs to be reset. All key institutions are broken. We're definitely going to speak about our journey to resuscitating the country, resuscitating the economy, rebuilding key economic, social, political institutions of the country, reuniting the people that have been sharply divided deliberately by Mr. Museveni, along ethnic, religious, and other lines. And therefore, we're going to give an indication of our considered route to recovering the soul of the country, so that we are able to unite our people to work towards a common goal of recovering every other sector. In a nutshell, it is resetting the country. All economic, political, social sectors are broken.
What do you think are the realistic prospects of your party in winning the presidency, pretty much defeating incumbent president Yoweri Museveni, who remains formidable and has won elections in the past, and his supporters are saying he will win again convincingly in next year's elections?
Speaking about Mr. Museveni winning any election previously is an insult to the people of Uganda, who have suffered the brunt of Museveni's brutality at every round of a considered election in this country. He's the most brutal being, perhaps, south of the Sahara. People have been maimed in the name of elections. People have lost their eyes in the name of elections. At every round of elections, if you read any observer reports, be them foreign observer reports, local reports, death as a result of, regime brutality and violence by the regime using its security apparatus have been awash. There's not such an election being won. And all cases before the Supreme Court in Uganda have reported extreme violence and rigging. They only lacked courage, like other courts have done in the region, to reject the outcome of the election.
Parliamentarian Mathias Mpuuga is a deputy president of the Ugandan Opposition National Unity Platform, NUP. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. Emily Estelle, American Enterprise Institute expert on Africa, warns that Ethiopia could risk sliding into a civil war. Tensions follow recent internal conflict in the Horn of Africa country. In an article, Ms. Estelle warns that the conflict could fracture the country's unity as well as incite regional violence. This, she contends, could plunge the region into a humanitarian crisis. Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has announced that several efforts by his federal government to avoid any conflict with the Tigray region have failed. He has since announced a military offensive against the Tigray region. This after accusing regional troops of attacking a military post housing military personnel from the federal government. To learn more about her concerns in a latest article regarding the current situation in Ethiopia, I reach Emily Estelle of the American Enterprise Institute.
There are a couple different factors at play, and there can certainly be blame assigned on both sides. Basically, what's happened is that in the transition since Prime Minister Abiy's come to power, there's been consistent tension and no real reconciliation between leadership in Tigray region, who was, you know, kind of in power before he came in. And so in the intervening years, those tensions have only gotten worse. And frankly, kind of both sides are responsible for ramping that up. The rhetoric's been very bellicose on both sides. The exact picture of who started this round of hostilities is still unclear, but both sides were ready to participate in it.
You know, the Prime Minister had a Nobel Laureate Award not too long ago, but does this latent tension, which could possibly degenerate into a civil war, tarnish his Nobel Laureate status or the shine of it?
Yes, I think so. So certainly he's had some remarkable accomplishments, and you can look at the peace with Eritrea as part of it, but this is turning into a civil war, and that is kind of certainly a big danger for the country and a risk that things will get more and more unstable. One thing to watch is that this is probably not going to stay limited just to one region, because there are other parts of Ethiopia that are struggling with unrest that may not be directly related to this conflict right now. But there are kind of many challenges, and I'm concerned about, you know, the cohesion in different parts of the country. And I think depending on how it goes, that could certainly kind of tarnish the Nobel Prize. The flip side of that is that Abiy is able to have pull forward through this really difficult moment, then that may be an even greater accomplishment in the long run.
Well, the Prime Minister, Abiy Ahmed, was accused of a power grab. Is the accusation legitimate?
So with the particular question of delaying the elections, I think there are a lot of viable reasons to do so given the pandemic, but that is not the first time he's been accused of kind of amassing more power than maybe he should have. And I think there are some pitfalls that have come up for him as he's been trying to consolidate, and he's maybe erred too far to that side. So I think that is a fair criticism to a degree. I think the way to deal with that, though, would have been through a more kind of mediated process rather than the way things have gone now.
People have expressed concern about the deteriorating relations between the Prime Minister and the TPLF. Do you think this could be repaired?
Yes, I think so. And I think that we're actually in a very critical window right now where, you know, if the fighting stops now and there is a serious move towards negotiations and to reconciliation, then yes, I think there's a chance to turn it around. There needs to be calls for the people inside Ethiopia, from the region, from the international community. There really needs to be unity on the need to come to the table, and we've got an opportunity. The longer the fighting goes on, the harder that is to do, because there will only be more casualties and more grievances, and everyone's going to get more dug in. So it's important for that conversation to happen fast.
There are fears of possible regional instability due to what many see as a possible spillover of the conflict in Ethiopia spilling over across the border into the Horn of Africa region. Do you foresee this happening?
Yes, I think there are a few different possible outcomes. One, and the one that's probably most likely, is that there will be conflict along the border with Eritrea, given the historical animosity between the president of Eritrea and the TPLF. There have already been accusations from the TPLF leadership that there are forces coming in from the Eritrean side. So that's the first one to watch. Another concern would be that as Ethiopian forces that are engaged in Somalia in the fight against al-Shabaab, as they return to Ethiopia given the crisis, there may be follow-on effects for the stability of Somalia because of the African Union mission there being disrupted.
What should the international community, as well as regional and continental forces, including the East Africa community, the African Union, and the rest of the international community, should be concerned with what is going on in Ethiopia?
I think they need to be concerned about not just the impact this will have on the Ethiopian people, which is certainly very significant, but also the larger regional picture. It's hard to overstate how important Ethiopia is, you know, in East Africa and the regions beyond. It's a powerhouse. It's a big country. It's really important politically and economically, the seat of the AU, all of these things. And, you know, this conflict has the potential to spin out of control in all sorts of different ways. And Ethiopia also has so much potential to be a source of stability and economic growth in this region, that everyone should be invested in its positive trajectory and not having this fighting flare up. You know, we have enough global crises right now. This is certainly not one that would serve any country's interest. There isn't really any player of all the many international players that have interest here who would benefit from a severely destabilized Ethiopia. So I hope that we'll see unity on trying to move this in a positive direction. I remain very concerned, but also, you know, hopeful that this is something that actually, you know, the international community can agree on.
Emily Estelle is the American Enterprise Institute's expert on Africa. She spoke with me from Washington, D.C. Says it's reopened airports for international travel on Monday, with land borders falling on December 1, with all visitors required to provide proof of a negative test for COVID-19. For viewing, Kodise Dube reports from the Botswana capital, Habaroni.
President Mokgweetsi Masisi announced yesterday that the country's borders will reopen in a phased manner. However, strict COVID-19 protocols be adhered to. Visitors are required to produce a COVID-19 negative result no more than 72 hours after testing. Masisi said symptomatic travelers will be denied entry or quarantined before being allowed into the country. The move to ease travel restrictions come as the Southern African country experiences a rise in COVID-19 cases. Giving an update this week, COVID-19 Presidential Task Force Team Deputy Coordinator Professor Msibili Msibili called the increase worrying. The country recorded an average of 200 daily cases in the last week, up from 100, while COVID-19 related deaths are now at 27.
Last time we reported on the 24th of October, we had an indicator that there were 24 Botswana who had passed away with an underlying, with the associated diagnosis of COVID-19. Now we report an additional 3. We recorded 1,193 cases total over a period of between the 25th of October and the 1st of November, averaging somewhere between 150 to 200 cases daily.
But despite the threat posed by the disease, some migrants are eager to return home. Cephas Chuma is a member of the migrants community in Botswana.
We really appreciate the move. Maybe if it was done even earlier, it could have been opened earlier, let's say maybe around the 15th, thereabout, so that you have a month to analyze and assess the situation, what impact does it bring before you get to the busy week of the festive season. Either way, the risk was there, so it was just an issue, in my view, it's just an issue of which devil you choose.
He believes the COVID-19 protocols put in place are sufficient to curb the cross-border spread of the disease.
The systems that have been put in place in terms of the testing, what is expected when you come back, all that, to me, it really makes sense. It actually gives a confidence in terms of managing the pandemic, because if you're coming back and you are assessed, and then it's at point of assessment that they would decide where you go. Is it quarantine? Is it what?
Botswana follows in the footsteps of its neighbors, South Africa and Zimbabwe, in easing travel restrictions. Like Botswana, South Africa is experiencing a rise in cases, with authorities warning of a possible return to stricter COVID-19 regulations. For VOA, this is Mkondisi Dube in Habaroni, Botswana.
And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of the Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, People's Democratic Party, or PDP, says it will resist any attempt by the government to censor or regulate social media. The party says any attempt to restrict citizens from freely expressing their views on social media platforms, including Twitter and Facebook, is a violation of the Constitution, which guarantees free speech. The PDP's comments come after the Northern Governors Forum expressed support for an ongoing effort to regulate social media. It forms part of the effort to check the spread of fake news on social media platforms in the country. Supporters of the ruling party say failure to provide regulation would allow some Nigerians to undermine the country's unity and territorial integrity. But the PDP disagrees, saying restrictions on free speech are unconstitutional and an affront to Nigeria's burgeoning democracy. Kola Ologbodiyan is the spokesperson for the Nigerian Main Opposition Party, PDP. He tells me that any attempt by the ruling party and supporters to violate the constitution is unacceptable.
Our position is predicated on the fact that our nation already has enough implementable laws that will counter the dissemination of fake news and punish anyone found to be behind fake news. So for us, we believe that the All Progressives Congress, as a party and its administration, should firmly express their readiness to guarantee and address the issues of corruption, treasury looting, abuse of human rights, nepotism, and unaccountability in government. This is what the media, the civil society, the opposition political parties are using their social media to achieve, and we believe that the APC government is becoming uncomfortable with the fact that Nigerians have access to the media using the social media. And that is why they are out to crack down on Nigerians.
But Kola, some people are arguing that it appears some Nigerians are using social media platforms to create instability, create tension, and create hatred to security agencies whose members are just carrying out their constitutionally mandated duties. What do you say to that?
The People's Democratic Party does not subscribe to these opinions. For us, we have seen that the social media has enabled the youth to be able to ask questions from government. It has also enabled the youth, and particularly majority of Nigerians, to raise the issues of accountability, competence, as well as exposure of massive corruption, unbridled treasury looting, barefaced injustice, human rights abuses, constitutional violations, and divisive actions of the current government. This has made the current government uncomfortable, and that is why they are determined to strangulate the use of social media.
What do you say to those who are of the opinion and who support legislation to regulate fake news in Nigeria, which they say usually is spread on social media platforms that are not regulated and the information not verified, which catches wildfire in Nigeria?
The PDP is not in support in any manner and in any way of fake news. But what we are saying is that you do not hide under the cover of regulating fake news and strangulate the use of the social media. We have provisions in our external laws that provide for punishment for those who try to use the social media to create fake news. So what we are saying is that, as a party, is that make provision, ensure that you deploy the use of such laws. You don't go out and try to hide under the fact that there are fake news in the media space, and you want to strangulate the entire process just because you have become uncomfortable with the increase in the level of criticisms of your government.
Will the PDP support any measure at all to regulate social media in Nigeria, particularly when people have expressed concern that social media in Nigeria is like the wild, wild west?
As a political party, the People's Democratic Party has already stated, and very clearly so, that it will not support any attempt to strangulate the social media under the guise of going after fake news reporters. And this is the position of the People's Democratic Party as we speak.
Kola Ologbodiyan is the spokesperson for the Nigerian main opposition party, the PDP. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Still in Nigeria, human rights groups have condemned the seizure of the passport of a lawyer who provided free legal service to protesters. The Immigration Service says it has confiscated the passport of Modupe Odeli at the Murtala Mohammed International Airport in Lagos as she prepared to fly out of the country. The government agency said it did so because Ms. Odeli is under investigation. But civil society and human rights groups have condemned the seizure of the passport, saying this is yet another attempt by the government to intimidate and harass the lawyer. They argue that the move is aimed at serving as deterrent to defense lawyers who plan to provide legal service to the detained protesters. Meanwhile, in the tweet Friday, Ms. Odeli said the Immigration Service has asked her to come for her passport. She told them she will do so on Monday. Olumide Alabi is a human rights lawyer. He tells me that Ms. Odeli's rights were violated after the government seized her passport. He adds that the lawyer was carrying out a constitutional commitment to legally represent anyone accused of crime.
My reaction basically centers on the fact that it is an infringement on her right. The government has actually shown that the government is not interested in respecting human rights. And the government is a government that is mainly interested in having every citizen caged and in such a way that no one should be a mouthpiece for them. It is obvious that the constitution of this country gives every lawyer, by virtue of his or her call to the Nigerian bar, the lawyer is expected to uphold justice and to make sure that he or she fights for the right, on behalf of the rights of people. That is part of the oath we have taken as a lawyer. Now, when people are being harassed, the best person to run to when their right is being infringed upon is a lawyer, a legal practitioner. So the Constitution made a provision for that. Every person should have a right to legal representation. So if the government is now preventing or encouraging people not to present their case before a legal practitioner of their choice, that would help to present their case in court or to advocate their cause. Automatically, the government is leading, is actually moving towards dictatorial tendency.
The Immigration Service says it confiscated the passport of Ms. Odeli because she is under investigation. Shouldn't the government take such an action if the lawyer is under investigation?
Investigation as to what? As to the fact that she is rendering service to people whose rights are being infringed upon. We know all these things. We know the tactics of the government in this country. Once they know that they want to come for you, they'll find an excuse. They'll find a means of really caging you, find you being roped. So it is not even the right time for the government to raise such issues now. Now that means the government is not even interested in listening to the yearning of the ENSAS protesters. They were not even expecting that anything fruitful will come from the Commission of Inquiry or the panel of inquiry that different states are now planning to set up, in that is majorly interested in providing reconciliatory and the mood and to provide the answers or to rectify the wrong that has been done during that particular ENSAS protest. I believe the government, through the immigration, they have a form of action order for daily or daily to be restricted. The movement should be restricted.
I understand the Nigerian Bar Association, from its branches and from the leadership, is planning to provide some form of service to help Ms. Odeli. What are you hearing?
Yes, the president of the Nigerian Bar Association, Olumide Akpata, has actually done marvelously well in this line. He has provided a pro bono services to those whose rights were being infringed upon, and the ENSAS protesters that were being detained all over Nigeria. A lot of them are still being detained. Now, the question is this. If those people that were being detained now, and the president of the NBA is now providing pro bono service, is that not synonymous to what Odeli was, what she was doing at that time, in terms of rendering legal services to these people whose rights were being infringed upon? Why would the government not go after the NBA president to also seize his international passport. Why would the immigration not going against the Olumide Akpata as well? But I just sense the fact that the government is not being sincere about the promotion and protection of human rights in Nigeria.
Some people are saying that the seizure of Ms. Odele's passport, as well as the announced investigation by the government, could serve as a deterrent to lawyers to represent the NSAS protesters who have been arrested. Is this what you see from your perspective?
Absolutely. That is what I'm saying, that they want to prevent lawyers from coming in. But Nigerian lawyers are strong-willed people. We are not. Human rights lawyers are not being deterred. Any form of opposition or antagonistic nature coming from government, we know their tactics. Even during the military era, this was the move. Remember, the present president of this country had such a record of being a former military dictator. So they do not want anyone to challenge their authority. That is exactly what it is. But the NBA, we are not relenting. And human rights activists and lawyers are not relenting also in Nigeria. We are still fighting and saying that no, the human rights, by virtue of the fact that the International Declaration of Human Rights and certain treaties that Nigeria has belonged to in the international community and our constitution gives room for our rights to be protected. We are human beings. We are Nigerians. We are not to be caged in our home country. We have the right to freedom of expression and freedom of association. The government cannot take that right away from us.
Olumide Alabi is a human rights lawyer. He spoke with me from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos. And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Believe me, love with you, baby, yeah. Anani, beleka, far, far, far. Anani, beleka, far. Anani, beleka, far, far, far. Anani, beleka, far. Anani, beleka, far, far, far. Anani, beleka, far. Anani, beleka, far, far, far. Anani, beleka, far.
Anani, beleka, far, 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 far. Anatetemeka kama na kifaa. Anataka ni mfaa. Fa fa fa. Kalala kifo cha mene mtoto kama kafa. Hata kuchiti sifi kabisa ya meniga sumaku. Tena tunapiga na mapicha picha kesho kwa peji za udaku. Snapchat, TikTok. Tunakomesha tuwa knock knock. Kitu ipo safi stop stop. Basa na voi lamba kalol pop.
Can you believe me baby? Unakonataka chamkwezi. Taninga uye mbezi. Uye na vitu flani yote nezi. Fa fa fa.
Come on, umesika. What we say? But dang 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 dang
dang dang dang dang dang dang dang dang dang dang dang dang dang. Anani, beleka, beleka, fa, fa, fa. Anani, beleka, beleka, fa. Anani, beleka, beleka, fa, fa, fa. Anani, beleka, beleka, fa. Anani, beleka, beleka, fa, fa, fa. Anani, beleka, beleka, fa. Anani, beleka, beleka, fa, fa.
I'm
Come on. el tuyo y tú es singular. Ninguém tem essa tua forma de me amar. Teu toque me faz arrepiar. Beijar a tua boca me faz sonhar. Só tu, baby. Não tem como tu, baby. Eu quero ser só tua e te levar pra lua.
Music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Dallas Mpuga, and producer Saida Hamdu, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, if you fill your head with pride, you will lack space for wisdom. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.